If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome back to The Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison. On this week's podcast, COVID, 1 year on. A year after the first case of the novel coronavirus was diagnosed in the UK, and in the middle of a second wave vastly worse than the first, how has the NHS fared during the biggest challenge of its history? Health expert Roy Lilly joins us to explain what's going on. Plus, whatever happened to small business? A double whammy of COVID and Brexit has fallen hardest on independent firms, the ones that used to make up the bedrock of Conservative support. As customers' forms pile up, might they look elsewhere for political representation in future? And what's the future looking like for travel? In an uncertain world of border closures and new COVID variants, will holidaymakers and business travellers even want to go abroad? All that and more on today's Bunker. Welcome back to the weekly panel edition of The Bunker. We hope you're enjoying the podcast and extras like our weekend special with Nick Cohen from The Observer, talking to Laura Spinney, author of Pale Rider, The Spanish Flu of 1918 and How It Changed the World. If you are, you could do us a favour and review and rate us on Apple Podcasts. It helps get the podcast to more people and spreads the word. Let's meet the panel for today. Hello to the editor of the LSE's COVID blog. You can follow it at LSE Public Policy on Twitter. It's Roz Taylor. Hello, Roz.
Hello.
What did you make of the EU's swiftly withdrawn threat to erect a vaccine border on the island of Ireland at the weekend? Was it as bad a clangour as it appeared?
Well, it was certainly a very bad clangour, but I don't think it was much more than a massive screw-up by an official. Essentially, I mean, this is someone in the European Commission whom Ursula von der Leyen has now publicly blamed, incidentally, rather than taking the responsibility on herself, who screwed up. And it was very quickly reversed. And considering how difficult this could have got, I thought that it was handled reasonably well. And I don't normally say this, but on the British side in particular, there was not a lot of angry rhetoric, not from the government anyway. Of course, there was plenty in the media, but the government was fairly restrained and this was a problem that was rectified. That said, it exposed very brutally the problem of not having a border on the island of Ireland when one part of that island of Ireland is in the EU and the rest isn't, and all the consequent problems that arise from that. Brexiteers were warned repeatedly that it would create problems with smuggling and border controls, and and this is a prime example of the EU fearing that there would be an attempt to move vaccines from one part of the island of Ireland to the other without their permission.
The row, such as it was it really between the EU and the UK? Was it between the EU and AstraZeneca? I mean, David Alden Green, friend of the podcast, wrote, just as the European Commission was wrong in invoking Article 16, though it was promptly reversed, it looks as if it was also wrong in how it publicly characterised the contractual obligations of AstraZeneca.
Yes, and this is partly a result of the UK being very closely identified with the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine. And of course, that is something which the UK government has been very keen to play up. Countries like being responsible for successful vaccines, although it has to be said this isn't quite as efficient as the Moderna and Pfizer BioNTech ones. But nonetheless, it's been a British success story. So what happens when you have that? Very vaccine nationalism is really the only way to put it, that countries, when a country is associated with a particular vaccine, then it starts becoming not a EU versus a company problem, but an EU versus country problem.
There'll be long-term consequences from this, because the fear is that this is going to be the cudgel that gets waved around forever about how awful the EU is.
Yes, in terms of it's ammunition for Euroscepticism, potentially. It does have that. I'm surprised it hasn't had a greater effect on public opinion. I don't think people have quite caught up with that narrative yet. But I think the lasting consequence is an increasing mistrust between the EU and the UK, which, it has to be said, the Commission has played its part in fostering and in encouraging. And also, of course, it means a lot more work for lawyers. Contracts are going to have to be much more tightly written now. It's going to have to be quite clear whether first come, first served means first come, first served, which is what the UK was saying. You know, we bought these doses, we're entitled to them. You didn't commit to later, so you're not entitled to them till later. There's going to have to be a lot of clarification on that point.
Also on today's panel, it's Times Radio host Aisha Hazarika. Hello, Aisha. How are you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you?
All right, not bad. Well, as Ross said, the vaccine rollout is actually going well in the UK for once. Almost 9 million people have been vaccinated. Is it good to acknowledge it when your political opponents get something right?
Yeah, I think it's really important to acknowledge it. Look, you know, we've all got skin in this game and we actually do want our government to succeed. Like, we all want this vaccine to be rolled out. We want to try and be successful in terms of managing this virus, which we haven't done a great job on. And I've been very critical, as we all have, of the government on many things. And, you know, this week also marked the really tragic milestone of 100,000 deaths. But it is important and it's right and it's fair if you're in, you know, if you're trying to be sort of objective, which I think, you know, we all try to do as much as we can. You do have to say they've done a good job on it. I mean, the figures just over the weekend were amazing. You know, sort of, I think we've hit a high of 600,000 people getting vaccinated in 1 day. And it's a bit, but what is interesting is that they've strategically done a good job, but the other thing they've done correctly was to use the structure of the NHS and to use that healthcare structure of GPs and things like that. And of course, you know, the army has played a role in it. So yeah, I don't think you lose anything. I think you can still be a critic of the government, but you can still also say on this, they've done a good job.
And you've been retweeting the Oxford vaccinologist Sandy Douglas, who's been saying the UK actually does have a reasonable claim to saying, you know, it is a UK manufactured vaccine because we actually did fund the development as well as the manufacture. I mean, though it sticks in the teeth, is it a little bit of a Brexit benefit?
Yeah, I did. You're right. I did retweet him. And the reason I thought it was interesting is the EU used the analogy of, you know, it's not like queuing up at the butchers. And he made the point, well, actually, we helped to invest to make sure that the butcher shop was actually up and running. And I do think that is important because, like, investment in R&D is really, really important. And that's something that, you know, we should applaud the government for doing. You know, they should do that. That's an important thing to do. I mean, it's really difficult. Is this a huge benefit of Brexit? Well, of course, this has gone well. Does this mean that, you know, oh, right, let's all change our view on Brexit?
Yeah.
No, but I do think we have to be honest about looking at the politics of this. This has been a gift to Boris Johnson on Brexit. And I absolutely agree with Roz that it's been really interesting watching the government minister's response, which has actually been quite smart, which is not to lay into the EU because they don't really have to. You know, when your enemy is kind of messing it up for themselves, it's actually smart for you to say nothing and try and take I don't think they're taking the moral high ground for the sake of taking the moral high ground. I think they're smart enough to work out that actually this looks terrible for the EU and for once does look really good for Boris Johnson and Brexit right now.
Today's guest is one of those millions of people who's had their shot, and he was a major hit when he was on the show during the first lockdown back in May. Welcome back to health policy analyst, writer, broadcaster and commentator Roy Lilly. Hello, Roy. How are you?
Andrew, I'm super good. Thank you.
It sounds like the vaccine is agreeing with you. Tell us about how you got your jab. How was it?
It was fantastic. I have to say, you know, I went into this whole thing with a bundling, oozing with scepticism as I normally approach life. But I pitched up at the Excel conference centre, which I have spoken at several times. It's like a big tin, horrible warehouse. It's a nightmare to speak at a conference there. You get the clattering, the teacups and the noise of the conferences outside and all this. I hate it. But so I pitched up there, you know, full of scepticism. And a very nice man opened the door and said, "Good afternoon, sir. Are you here for your COVID injection?" I said, "I am." He said, "Yeah, just a minute, I'll get some." And a volunteer then took me and put me socially distanced in the queue. And she said, "Will you be all right there or do you need a seat?" So I said, "No, I'm fine, thank you." She said, "Good." She said, "I don't think you'll be very long." And the queue sort of shuffled along. What I'd normally seen the XL being, this sort of cacophony of noise and clatter, suddenly is turned into a cathedral of quiet and social distance. And it's like ethereal. And everybody moved along almost at waltz time. And these wonderful ushers, a bit like if anybody listening to this went to the Olympic Games back in 2000 and whenever it was, and they had all these games helpers ushering the queues, and what a wonderful spirit and attitude they had. They've replicated it absolutely at the XL. These fantastic people. And some young lady said to me, she said, "Well, you're at the beginning of the end now." And, you know, I thought, give her a hug, you know. And you can just see they're all beaming with smiles. I mean, they're all wearing masks, but you can see it in people's eyes and their body language. And anyway, so then I sat down with a very nice lady behind the screen. She said, "Can I see your," and they, you have to give you a bit of paper with your numbers on all this. She said, "Oh, yes, Mr. Lilly. Right, let's just have a look." And she'd, "Oh, yes." She sort of fondled her iPad and she said, "Oh, yes, here you are. That's good, isn't it?" I thought, "Well, yes, it is good. You know, you found me on an NHS database straight away, miles from anywhere." And then I went into a little pod where I met a lovely lady who is a member of the St. John's Ambulance. She's been with St. John's Ambulance for 40 years. She did my jab. We had a little chat about doing my jab. In fact, she did it and I hadn't realized she'd done it. I felt cheated. I wanted to wince or at least have some stabbing memory of it. You know, I've no memory at all of her doing it. I said, "Are you sure you've done it?" She said, "Yes, it's all right, dear. You know, I've done it." And then I walked out and there was a sort of line of ushers seeing me out. And it was almost as if they wanted to say, "Do come and see us again soon."
The next pandemic, yes.
Exactly. Well, and I walked out and I stood, and I have to tell you, I had a tear in my dry, old, cynical eye, and I thought, these people are wonderful. It's being run by Barts, of course, Barts Hospital, which is just down the road, by a very bright young manager called Jan Flint, and I subsequently found out who it was. It is excellent, absolutely excellent. The XL excels with excellence.
My mum had hers done at the weekend on Merseyside, and she said that the people, everybody went to get their jab and actually put their best clothes on because it's the first day out they'd had in a year.
Yes.
She said it was like going to a tea dance.
Listen, I must tell you, I've been lounging on my, I'm built for lounging about on the sofa. I've been a year on the sofa wearing tracky bottoms, you know, because if I'm on the telly or something, I just put a jacket and a shirt on the top and everybody thinks, "Oh, very smart," but I've actually had my tracky bottoms on. Well, I thought, as I'm going over to the XL, I better put some trousers on. So I put some you can guess the rest of the story anyway. Yeah. So, I've got another notch in my belt.
Well, it has now been a year since the first case of coronavirus was diagnosed in the UK. We've had over 3.8 million instances of the virus and, of course, over 100,000 deaths. And it does seem clear that this is the NHS's worst crisis. Is it passing that test? Roy, when you were on the show last year, you said that this was the biggest challenge since the birth of the NHS. We're now a year on into a worse phase. What state is our health service in? You just say about how they, you know, for vaccination itself, they're actually being able to, finally come into their own. How is the NHS performing overall on COVID?
It's on the ragged edge, I think. To be honest, right now, I mean, there's been loads of coverage. There's been a shift, of course, with NHS England's comms people. At one time, they were trying to keep the press out of hospitals. The philosophy was they didn't want people to see how bad it was, I think, and only, you know, the BBC or the Pool went in to record under specific circumstances. Now they've pretty much opened up all the ITUs and all the hospitals. You've got regional news teams going in as well, and people can see for themselves the NHS is on the ragged edge. And of course, the big worry is now there's this mountain of people, this tidal wave of people who have been waiting for elective procedures, you know, new hips, new knees, cataracts, hernias, and of course, cancer operations. So the NHS is going to be busy, you know, from here to Flagtown. I can't imagine, you know, what it's going to be for the next 3 or 4 years. So I think they are just about surviving on the ragged edge, but it's been a huge and gargantuan effort by everybody, but we can't overlook the trauma that it takes. I mean, most people working in ITU are used to people dying. but they're not used to people dying on an industrial scale like this is, and it's done a hell of a lot with their heads, the minds of particularly nurses working in these very difficult circumstances. So, and of course, it's hidden the fact that we went into the COVID pandemic with about 40,000 nurses short. The government said that we've recruited another 13,000. Yes, but a lot have retired and have left. There's a big workforce problem that COVID is hiding, and that's got to be sorted out as well. So it's hanging on by its fingernails, I think.
One of the paradoxes of the NHS is that it has to show that it's coping in order to, you know, maintain public support. It has to be seen to work. But also, to a degree, you're just mentioning there, news crews being allowed in so that people can get finally an idea of what it's like. People have to understand how serious things are in order to kind of, you know, to maintain that political pressure to support it. Do you think, you know, that walking that knife edge of being, you know, clearly able to deal with the crisis, but also to show how serious the crisis is that being walked okay? Do people fully understand what the NHS situation is?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure they do. And let's face it, you know, there are 300,000 nurses working in the NHS. They all go home and they tell 300,000 husbands, wives, boyfriends, girlfriends, families, you know, what it's really like. So, I think the public do get that. And there is a bit of a sort of sophistry going on here about, you know, stay home, save the NHS. Well, the NHS doesn't need saving. The NHS needs to be given the gap and the space so that it can look after people with COVID and look after the millions of other people have got a shit a lot wrong with that. You know, people are still falling off their bikes and they're still smashing up their cars and they're still, you know, cutting their finger off with a carving knife with a Sunday joint. So there's plenty for the NHS to do. So it's still very, very busy. You know, you can see what's going to happen, can't you? You know, Johnson, who's running around, you know, he loves having his picture with his high-vis jacket on and his helmet wherever he goes. You know, he's going to wrap himself in the NHS flag and say the vaccination thing has saved Britain and aren't I clever? You know, everybody's ready for that for the next election. So the NHS you can compare and contrast what's happened in other countries where you've got federalized health systems, where you've got insurance-based health systems. Look how dysfunctional the American system has been. They, you know, they're still only vaccinating, you know, half a dozen people a day. You've got the Germany system has pretty much failed. The French system is in a real mess. The Italian system's in a real mess. We have a national health system and it's functioning and it's doing its thing. And I think this has really highlighted the value of the NHS. And of course, it will be politically hijacked. You can see it coming.
Ross, you identified this in our sort of conversations outside of the podcast, that, you know, the Nightingale hospitals, for instance, were able to be built really quickly, but the issue was not that there weren't patients, that there weren't enough staff to support their use. How can that be rectified when, you know, people see it now and they see it? It's, you know, yes, it's an absolute national treasure, but it also looks like a terrifying and pressured place in which to work.
Yeah, it is. And we can train more people, but it is a long-term job to train people. It takes 7 years to train a doctor, for example. It takes, you know, most nurses are graduates now. You need time. Now, one of the successes of the vaccination operation has been bringing in a large number of volunteers because there's plenty of people who can help and help out people like Roy today with his vaccination, who don't need medical qualifications. They just need to be able to do the meet and greet and the admin. And it's been able to bring in a large number of those people. And that's been a real success, because it's given people, some of whom are, you know, furloughed, don't necessarily have a lot to do. It's given them a purpose, something to do, and it's made them feel part of it. And it's been a great way of boosting an inadequate workforce. But when you think about what will actually keep people in their jobs, which is also the important thing now, because there's going to be a lot of people who are absolutely exhausted after what they've been through working in ICU, what is going to be needed to retain them? And if you look at the research, it tends to be not necessarily pay. It's not always pay. It's actually being listened to and being heard and being able to have time off when you need it because you're exhausted and stressed. And I think that is going to be the big challenge for the NHS to ensure that can happen while still trying to keep up, you know, to catch up with the backlog of missed operations that they've got. I think in terms of funding, which you were talking about earlier, and how to persuade people now that the NHS should be funded, I think people have been saying recently, oh, you know, this vaccine rollout, if it continues to be a success, it's going to be a great boost for Johnson. True, it will be a great boost for Johnson, but it will also be a powerful, powerful argument for paying more taxes for the NHS. And I think if the government is sensible, it will make a point when the inevitable need for tax rises comes. It will point out, we vaccinated you. We vaccinated you as soon as we could. This is a universal benefit that you have, and now it's time to give back. And I very much hope that it won't just be a boost for Johnson. In fact, obviously, I hope it won't be a boost for Johnson. I hope it will be a boost for the case for funding the NHS.
Ayesha, the most recent YouGov poll on which party would be best at handling the NHS was Labour at 35% compared to the Conservatives on 26%. Labour's always been seen as strongest on the NHS. Is it strongest on the NHS now, or is it being a little bit too quiet as it attempts to not, as it were, undermine the national effort?
Well, you're correct in saying that Labour traditionally has always been more trusted on the NHS and public services, although I think there was a period recently before the last election when Conservatives slightly overtook Labour, which was a kind of a worrying signal about what was ahead. I think Labour is in quite a difficult position on this. Keir Starmer has set out to try and be a constructive opposition now. I think he, in his soul, feels that that is the right thing to do. But also, one of the things that is absolutely clear from the focus group testings that the Conservatives have done and the Labour Party have done, the public do not want to see politicians having a huge kind of political stooshy over this when, you know, things are so, so bad. Now, that is a very difficult message to sell to lots of people who are really strongly upset about what's happening. It's a really difficult message to sell to activists. And of course, it's a very difficult message to sell to your echo chamber on Twitter, because of course, people are very, very understandably upset with how things are going in terms of the handling, with 100,000 deaths. And they're also now getting angry with Starmer for not kind of being oppositional enough. But one of the things that you will notice in Prime Minister's questions is that Boris Johnson kind of keeps saying, oh, you know, he's the leader of the opposition is not being constructive. He's trying to undermine. Now, he's saying that. I don't think Keir Starmer has at all tried to undermine things. If anything, you know, he has been unbelievably sort of gracious and, you know, some people think a bit limp on all of this, but they have focus grouped that. So they know that that is a message which is testing well with the broader public. And the thing that we, and I find this very difficult sometimes, my Twitter timeline is not the public in general. And that is very, very hard. Like so many people, you know, a lot of the circles, you know, my Labour Party circles are privately muttering, saying, you know, I just think, you know, Keir Starmer's got to be a bit more in the Prime Minister's face on this. He's got to be more aggressive. And I've got some sympathy with that. But it's also quite a difficult call for him to make, because if he does kind of steam in and start having a huge row on this now, a lot of people will say, hang on, I don't want the Prime Minister to be distracted having a huge row. We need them to focus, particularly when the vaccine program is going quite well. So it should be, in many ways, at the start, you know, from a strategy point of view for the Labour Party, you'd have thought, oh, actually, this is quite good for them, but it's now actually proving to be quite tricky for them.
Yeah, I agree with that. And, you know, if you look at Johnson, he stomps around the country shaking hands with people or bumping with people when he tells the rest of us to stay at home. His performances at Prime Minister's questions are just rude. I mean, it's, and I just think, you know, normal people look at it and think, what's he trying to do? But he has tagged Keir Starmer with being a ditherer. Starmer's fed into that by telling his troops to abstain on some key moments. So really, with a public look at this and think, well, who is any good? Who can I trust? Who is going to come out of this? And the public memory is very short. They will certainly remember the success of the vaccine program, but they may well forget the mess there was over masks, the reluctance to lockdown, the fiasco there's been in schools, and to a certain extent what's happened in care homes. You know, they will build up on the successes, and the public will, this is far too early, I think, perhaps is what I'm saying, to form any real opinion on who's doing well and who isn't, because it's still a confused mess, because neither side, I don't think, have really got a sophisticated line to push.
I think the weakest point is not now. The weakest point for Johnson will be when life gets back to normal, whenever that is, and people turn around and say, right, actually, my life, it's not as good as I thought it would be. Yeah, I can go out to the pub, but things are not that great. And then you'll get what I suspect will be a similar thing that happened to Churchill after the Second World War, where people were grateful to Churchill for having won the war, but then they wanted Attlee because they wanted a strong welfare state and they wanted their lives to improve in tangible ways. People are going to have very high expectations after this pandemic. We're all longing for it to finish. And what if real life isn't that great after all?
Well, this is not just an issue in the UK. Vaccination is going well here, but there are different levels of performance around the world. And one question that's arising is the global rush for the vaccine in danger of encroaching on human rights? Israel is a strong vaccination performer, but it has a data for doses deal with Pfizer, where early access to the vaccine is exchanged for access to health data. Lawrence O. Gostin is the director of the O'Neill Institute for National and Global Health Law and director of the World Health Organization Collaborating Center on National and Global Health Law. Here's what he had to say about it.
I'm Lawrence Gostin. I'm the founding O'Neill Professor of Global Health Law at Georgetown University, and I direct the World Health Organization Center on National and Global Health Law. Israel is leading the world so far in its vaccine rollout. Like other high-income countries, it's been fairly aggressive in signing pre-purchase agreements with pharmaceutical companies. Israel seems to have made a separate agreement with Pfizer to get extra doses of the Pfizer vaccine in exchange for data on vaccine recipients that Israel will then give to Pfizer. It's worrying because there's very little transparency. Israeli citizens and, frankly, the world citizens, they want to know what's the data going to be used for in terms of, you know, employment, immigration, law enforcement, a whole range of other things like that. Whether it's the UK, the European Union, the United States, or Canada, or Israel, they're buying up doses in secret advanced deals with pharmaceutical companies. There's some real ethical problems I have with that. Because it means that we've starved low and middle income countries of vaccine doses. And as a result, we're going to have, as Emmanuel Macron of France said, a two-speed world. It's very possible to see Israel, the UK, the US getting to herd immunity within 6 months. And it could take 6 years for some of the lowest income countries. The God's honest truth is that high-income countries have been quite greedy, quite selfish, and that's just not right. And as Martin Luther King said in the United States, all inequities are unjust, but the most unconscionable inequity are health inequalities, and that's what we're seeing highlighted during the COVID-19 pandemic. This is not just an ethical imperative. You know, sharing vaccines is not just the ethically right thing to do. It's actually in all of our self-interest. The Israeli case is a very clear one. You know, if you've got a population that's constantly going across borders, there's no way you're going to save and protect your population unless everyone's protected. It's in Israel's interests, and it is ethical, and it is the right thing to do to ensure that Palestinians are vaccinated. We also need to be sure that we do that for all populations around the world. Everyone has equal worth. Everyone has the same, you know, aspirations for health and safety and security and prosperity. And there's no reason morally or economically or politically why some should have so much protection and some should have so little.
Now, COVID and Brexit have been terrible for all small businesses, with only two exceptions, takeaways and podcasting. We've absolutely booming here. But lockdowns, customs chaos and reduced demand have disproportionately fallen on independent firms, the ones that used to be the bedrock of Conservative support. So are these voters going to be up for grabs at the next election? And what should Labour try to do to win them round from Boris fuck business, Johnson. Roz, we're seeing daily stories on the theme of, you know, I voted Brexit and now my export business has collapsed. I feel betrayed. Have those businesses just been filed in the memory hole by the government now that they've served their purposes and delivered their vote?
Yeah, essentially they have. I mean, the idea of Brexit was sold to these people on a promise of less red tape. The reality, of course, was a lot more red tape because you were now trading outside the single market. But that was the promise. And small businesses tend, understandably, to think that they'd be better off with less administration and red tape. And the Leave campaign played on those fears.
So we can at least say, I told you so, when it's a former Brexit MP like Lance Foreman who's wanting a bailout for his smoked salmon business. But it's very hard to have anything other than great sympathy for people who thought they were voting for one thing and very much got another. But this is the bedrock of conservatism. So something like 95% of UK firms are SMEs, 45% of total business revenue in the country, 60% of private sector investment. Is it possible to run a Conservative Party when you've basically junked a huge chunk of British business?
Yeah, let's not say I told you so, because it's really not helpful at this stage. People believed what they were told and what the government assured them, that it would all be okay. And that wasn't unreasonable. It was a perfectly natural thing to do for people who don't have a lot of spare bandwidth to think about politics. The trouble is that these businesses never even had the CBI to make the case for them, because they were all individual ones. Their export circumstances were often very different. They didn't have a big lobby group standing up for them. And at the time that they normally have been able to make a fuss about how bad it was going to be, i.e. 2020, and crucially, to be heard by the media, everybody was consumed, including the businesses themselves, by COVID. It was COVID, 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 with no space for anything else and no room for anything else. And for many businesses, it was a basic struggle to survive. And it still is. I mean, 1 in 7 SMEs is now at risk of going under because of COVID. So in a sense, Brexit has been a second order issue. And for some of them, it's now become very much a first order issue. But you can't blame them for having to contend with a lack of interest from the media and failing to, which wasn't listening to them last year.
I mean, we've seen consistent dismissal of the issues with red tape on import export as teething problems, both by the government and by its more explicit outriders. And the communications before the deal, such as it is, came through, were almost non-existent. They were just messages to prepare. Whatever that means, even though these businesses did not know what they were preparing for. Is there a tipping point where the government has to act in favour of these small businesses? Or is that old thinking? Is that old sort of, you know, pre-Johnson, pre-COVID thinking on my part?
Well, somebody's got to have a plan, haven't they? When we come out of this, the high street's going to be ruined. We've seen more shops being marooned and left today with the deal on Topshop and all the rest of it. You know, thousands of people without a job. It's not just that, it's the supply chain for the shops as well and the people who clean the windows and do the cleaning. So, the high street's been destroyed. A lot of small businesses won't exist anymore. Simply, I mean, like the bloke who makes the Stilton cheese can't export it anymore because he's got to pay 180 quid for every small packet he sends for a vet to say it's whatever it is. So, I mean, there's a load of bonker stuff still to come out. So somebody's got to have a Marshall-style plan, haven't they? We're going to build back better. Okay, we've got the phrase. What does it mean? What 10 things is one single political party going to do? What's Keir Starmer going to do? What 10 things is he going to do to build back business? What are the 10 things that Johnson's going to do to build back business? Neither of them have got a clue.
Ayesha, do you think it's possible for Labour to bring small business around? I mean, it worked for the Blair government when they managed to project competency on the economy as well as change, as it were. Is it possible? Can Labour get there?
Well, it's going to be very difficult because Labour hasn't been trusted on the economy for a very long time. And that's not just Jeremy Corbyn. That goes back to when I worked for Ed Miliband and, of course, the global financial crisis, which was absolutely not the Labour Party's fault, but that was the frame which the Conservative Party used against the Labour Party very successfully, even though the Conservative Party backed all the financial decisions that had been made by Gordon Brown. You know, why would you give the keys back to the guys that crashed the car was a sort of ruthlessly devastating attack line. And you have to go back in a bit of political history. I mean, the thing that always stymied the Labour Party and not trusted on the economy and That's the thing that Gordon Brown and Tony Blair worked so hard on, you know, right through the 90s to, you know, establish prudence and all of that kind of stuff. Now, what Gordon Brown had to do and Tony Blair had to do in the run-up to 1997 was show the public that they would be prudent with the public purse while investing in things that needed investment, like the NHS, like education. So this is the balance that Keir Starmer will find himself in. You know, he will have to convey, look, we will borrow to invest in things which will help build back better, as Roy said, but they do have to be mindful. Like, I know we have just had a spend-a-thon, but the public are still very socially conservative from a fiscal point of view when elections come around. Now, I hope that this pandemic will make people think much more about paying a bit more tax, as Roy said, to support the things that have, you know, been important to them. I think Labour does have an opportunity with this, but they also have this historic problem on the economy. But one of the things I am disappointed from Labour, though, in this period of time, I don't think people want to see huge politicisation of the COVID crisis, as we've discussed. But I do think they should be saying more about the problems that business are facing now. I think they're quite quiet on the business front. They scored a good win from the government last week, where they forced the government to U-turn on their plans to look at workers' rights, which had been. But they should be doing more, you know, and this isn't about relitigating Brexit, but this is an opportunity for the Labour Party to be out there pressing the flesh with business, even if it's on Zoom calls, but saying, look, we are going to stand up for you. Tell us what you need to make things easier. Because you're right, the great irony about where things were is that Labour was always associated with red tape, but Conservatives are now strangling businesses with red tape every which way. So I think there is an opportunity there, but Labour have got to be much more, like, you know, on the pitch on this.
Meanwhile, if there isn't enough crisis to go around, there's one in Italy for you. Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte resigned last week. Why? Well, we spoke to author and former Guardian journalist Tobias Jones in Parma to tell us.
Hi, I'm Tobias Jones. I'm a writer and journalist based in Parma and the author of Ultra. Why has Giuseppe Conte resigned? A very much minority partner in his government pulled support. So Matteo Renzi, who's the leader of the Italy Alive party that's polling at about 3%, decided that he would no longer support the government. He's previously pulled this trick. He pulled the plug on his own centre-left government so that he himself could become prime minister. Because Conte had this wafer-thin majority, even a minority partner could cause the government to collapse. So although Conte won a confidence vote last week, he resigned at the beginning of this week, basically because he knew that any government was unworkable unless there was a major sort of realignment of political parties. COVID is sort of relevant and not relevant. Conte's handling of the crisis has been fairly well received. The reason it's relevant is because 209 billion euros from the EU's recovery plan is about to drop into the Italian coffers. Renzi and other politicians are desperate to be holding the levers of power when that huge sum of money is distributed in all sorts of different directions. So it's really a question of power and patronage rather than any ideological difference. The public think that Renzi is purely doing this for his own ends. He is an incredibly greedy man. You know, just as this crisis broke, a video emerged of him being paid 80,000 euros to go to Saudi Arabia. But there are lots of other players in this on the right. You have Giorgia Meloni, who is the young blonde leader of the fascist party, Matteo Salvini's League, and still you have Silvio Berlusconi. The government is so fragile, a lot of people are wondering whether Berlusconi will be the kingmaker in all this, whether he will peel off from that centre-right coalition and actually decide to support Conte. the feeling is that a lot of the parties in opposition would almost rather stay in opposition for another year or two and let this current government take all the flak for all the unpopular things it's going to do, the lockdowns and the restrictions and the dreadful state of the economy. I suspect what is going to happen is there will be a new majority cobbled together with possibly Renzi eating humble pie and coming back into the tent, possibly Berlusconi, or possibly sort of disgruntled people from both those minority parties propping up the government, and it'll sort of stumble on for another year or two. Then we'll have a proper general election.
Finally, have you booked your holiday yet? Me neither. Coronavirus has torn up our relationship with travel. Border closures, quarantine periods, and a multitude of closures mean trips away are off for most of us. So will our relationship with going abroad for business and pleasure ever recover? Bookings for domestic holidays are reported to be surging at 200 to 300% of the usual volume. Aisha, at what point do you think you're going to go away again? Are you banking on anything this year?
Never. I don't think I'm ever going on holiday again. I'm never leaving the house, but I'm quite relieved because I'm never going to be bikini ready ever again in my entire life. In fact, if I get anywhere near the sea, I'm going to get harpooned the way things are right now. So I feel like the pressure's off a bit. But I have to say, I was never one for going on like super big hot sort of holidays because I'm Glaswegian and I really don't like the sun. I can't handle like being in the sun. But I am a bit, I don't feel the desire. I do think, you know, there's everything for me has slightly changed after this. I don't really want to get on a plane and be jammed up with lots of other people, but I want to go to Scotland. I think the staycation for me is definitely going to loom large in my life.
Michael O'Leary of Ryanair, he thinks that once travel restrictions are dropped, there will be a huge explosion of pent-up demand. Apparently, EasyJet's bookings for the summer are up 250%, which to me is, well, that's the definition of optimism. Do you think that sort of that those cheap impulse holidays are going to be something that's not going to come back?
It's difficult to say because some people are so desperate to get away. But I do think a lot of other people are worried about it. I also do think it's a bit irresponsible from the government to be sending out like so much mixed messaging on the summer. Like, you know, we had the Home Secretary saying, look, I don't think it would be, you know, wise to be sort of going away or booking your summer holidays. And certainly Dominic Raab kind of hinted that. And then you've got Matt Hancock saying, oh, I think we're all going to have a brilliant summer. And one of the problems is we all had a brilliant summer last year and we're all paid quite a heavy price for it. I think it's quite irresponsible. I think we have to send a message out. We will get through this, but we're not going to be snapping back to business as usual by the summer. And I think that is responsible messaging. I think we have to tell people we are actually going to be living a bit of a restricted life for a bit longer and just be honest with people. This idea that we're all going to be yomping about on holiday, I think it's just really irresponsible.
Ros, the backbone of the aviation industry has been business travel, the business class and higher fare. And obviously Zoom has paid for that for a lot of people. Do you think that's a permanent thing?
No, it's not a permanent thing. I think here the emphasis on what people actually do in business meetings will change. By the way, I mean, let's all, you know, take a moment to think about those people with thousands of air miles who just now cannot use them.
I mean, pray for them.
Yeah.
Yes.
But I think what matters, if you ask business people what really matters and what they will continue to travel for, it tends to be for meetings that involve a degree of trust. So basically, that's if you're going to spend some money, if you're doing a deal, if you're going to be starting a new business relationship with somebody. On the other hand, the stuff that was going to conferences and listening to presentations, which is what a lot of academics who I work with, for example, do, is more or less going to move online. There are some things that can be replicated on Zoom and there are some things that definitely can't. And I think you'll begin to see that difference. And also you'll begin to see a winnowing out of business travel anyway, I think, because Britain is going to become a less globalised place for a while. That is inevitable. Most countries are moving towards doing more and not consuming so many products from abroad. Even Joe Biden's America is. And naturally, if you're less globalised, then you have less business travel.
Yeah, and you know, I always found it, you know, friends who are off on a business trip, I was amazed at how little seems to get done from these things, how symbolic they are. They're sort of part of a business ritual rather than actually, you know, getting things done. And what you were saying there about trust, it's like the deal closing one is the one that needs to happen, but everything else can, it doesn't actually require physical presence in the same way.
Exactly.
Roy, I mean, health and vaccines and security of transmission of infection and so forth are huge determinants of this. From a health point of view, do you think it's likely that leisure travel is likely to open up soon?
Well, I think people are going to be cagey. And of course, we don't really know what the real benefit of a vaccination, even, you know, two shots, is going to be. The scientists still don't seem to be sure whether or not it will stop me transmitting the disease. It doesn't tell me whether or not I'm going to not get it, or well, I just won't get it quite so severely. So, you know, all of us really that have had this vaccination are still part of a huge clinical trial, which is why some of these companies want the data, because they want to know what the long-term assurance and guarantee is and how long the vaccination will last for. So I think until we've answered those questions, people will still be very skeptical about travel. I think that O'Leary, you know, in Ryanair, he's right. There'll be a lot of people who will just head for the beach because everybody used to be thoroughly fed up with it. In the same way that a lot of people have been heading for the beach here, lockdown or no lockdown, you know, there'll still be a whole group of people that will say, to hell with it, let's go and have a decent time. So, but I think, you know, more sensibly, we need to know more about what the vaccine will give us before we can determine what life will be like in 6 months' time.
You're desperate to get away yourself. Have you got to get your eye on anywhere, or will you be given another year?
There's a little place in Sicily that I'm not going to tell you where it is, but it's waiting for me, and the bougainvillea is floating across the pool, and the dry white wine is on ice.
So we've come to the end of the podcast, which means it's time to ask our panel for their escape routes from politics. The books, films, TV, show, music, whatever, that they're using to ward off the outside world. Roz, what is warding off the outside world for you at the moment?
I'm learning an awful lot about the ancient Egyptians, Andrew.
Oh,
I'm
really?
Now an expert on the ancient Egyptians, yeah.
Come on, Roz, talk like an Egyptian. That was really Alan Partridge, that wasn't it? Really Alan Partridge.
Yeah, I mean, obviously that's homeschooling, and so that is not an escape route. That is merely a duty.
Yeah.
I have been watching a lot of Junior Bake Off. That is also partly a duty. What I'm really looking forward to is the last season of Spiral on Grenage, which I am saving up as a special treat for myself every Friday night for an hour.
Mm. Aisha, how about you?
Well, I'm sure lots of people have been watching this, but it's a sin. It's just been an absolute modern masterpiece. I've watched it. I've started watching it again. Just so brilliantly done. And the ability to make you kind of laugh and then just make you howl, and also the education from it. The only thing that is, I mean, so much of it, which is hard to watch, but the scenes of the parties and the bars and the dancing is quite torturous right now, though, because it does make you want to go out and sort of get stuck in. But I just think it is, I genuinely think it's the most brilliant bit of television that I have seen in years.
Yeah, and the way it's landed now, it's come out just at a time when a population that might have seen the absolute necessity of going out a lot and being with people like yourself as not necessarily something that was important to them. Now we all know, everyone knows how important just human contact is, being out and about, meeting people. And it's like it couldn't have come out at a more appropriate, apposite time, could it?
Yeah, the timing is extraordinary. And also the fact that the contrast in terms of that was this huge health crisis, but it was dealt with in such a different way to how this health crisis is being dealt with. And also, you know, I was growing up at the time, I was obviously aware of it, but none of us knew those hidden stories, those stories of loss. And, you know, it's just a modern bit of history, really recent history, which was so covered up. And, you know, it's just been fascinating to see it all kind of laid bare. And the stories that are coming out, I interviewed a woman on my show on Sunday who worked on a gay switchboard at the time. It was like a helpline. And she was fascinating because she was saying that she worked on this helpline from the 80s into the 90s. and the calls that they would just get from people as this, you know, virus and disease was becoming, you know, prevalent. The heartbreaking stories, of course, which, you know, this series now has shone a light on. But also parents ringing up really confused because there was so little information and so little honest, compassionate information given out at the time. Parents just really unsure about what to do. And it's just brilliant, brilliantly done. But just more than anything, just education, like drama and education at its best.
How about you, Roy? What's giving you a mind break from reality at the moment?
Well, actually, funnily enough, I've kept in touch with a lot of my mates on Zoom. We have a night and we just sit and chat and have a drink on Zoom. So, and I've actually seen more of some people than I would have done, you know, if I'd got to travel or meet them in a bar or what have you. So I've done that. And the other thing is I've gone back to painting. I paint in watercolour. I'm doing a lot more painting and I'm, you know, really pleased to do it. And I think I've got better at it because it's like all the things, you know, the more you do, the better you get. So I've really enjoyed that. I have one thing I really have missed and I can't replicate, and that's going to visit the front line in hospitals and in primary care and getting out into the health service, because that's where I find inspiration from and the, you know, people doing the important jobs are. But fundamentally, I mean, I've been super lucky in lockdown, really, and I've got a lot to be thankful for.
Well, mine is Pretend It's a City on Netflix with Fran Lebowitz, Martin Scorsese's Walk and Talk with the unique and fantastic art critic and humorist Fran Lebowitz. And it's all about, it's Fran and her opinions. Fran is just an opinionator. The first couple of episodes center very much on life in New York and how annoyed she is with incomers and how annoyed she is with people who don't know how to walk down a street and how annoyed she is with people who look at their phone the whole time. Hence the title. Why don't you just pretend it's a city where you have to fit around other people? It's both fantastically funny and fantastically evocative of New York, but also really nostalgic for being in cities full of busy people. I live in a city, I'm surrounded by people, and I never see any of them because I'm in this back room talking on podcasts. We've all been separated from one another, and to see this thing, which is both about New York and it's about New Yorkers' obsession with New York, because obviously New Yorkers can't shut up about how great New York is and nowhere else in the world matters, but it's nostalgic. So it feels like a period piece, and it's brilliant, and it's really funny, and it's on Netflix now. And that is the end of this week's Bunker. So thanks to our special guest, Roy Lilly. Thanks for coming in.
It's a great pleasure, and good luck to everybody, and keep safe.
Welcome back soon. And thanks to Aisha Hazarika.
Oh, thank you so much, as ever.
And thanks to Ros Taylor for joining us.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow with another Bunker Daily and the full-length show this time next week. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you enjoyed the podcast, you can back the Bunker on Patreon. See our Twitter or Facebook, or just search Patreon Bunker Podcast for early shows, merchandise, and all kinds of other stuff, and some interesting news coming in the next few weeks. Backers, of course, get an honorary salute on the show, and here are some now.
Well, hello, and a big thanks from me to Fiona McFarlane, Alex Soden, David Thomas, and Alex Cornish.
Thanks from me to Ed Baker, Ian, Carl Axel Ackerson, and John Wood.
And finally, hello and best wishes from me to Keith Kelly, Rachel Brooks, Laurie Mansfield, and Stephen Evans. We'll see you all next time.
The Bunker was produced and presented by Andrew Harrison, with Ros Taylor, and Aisha Hazarika. The assistant producers were Jacob Archbold and Jelena Sofronievich, and audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Bunker is a Podmasters production.